In this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Travis Rim about his graduate work studying brown trout ecology in Spearfish Creek in the Black Hills region in South Dakota. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today volunteered himself to come on the show, which I would encourage others to do the same. Travis Rame grew up in southwest Montana fishing the banks of the Beaverhead River. His love of fish and the waters they inhabit led him to Montana State University, where he received his bachelor's degree in fish and wildlife management in 2013. During that time and the years following his graduation, he worked several fisheries technician jobs for state, federal, or private agencies across Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. He then went back to school and began his master's degree at South Dakota State University in 2016. His research project focused on brown trout ecology in the Black Hills region of South Dakota. He recently finished his degree at South Dakota State and has accepted a position as the Lake Roosevelt Fisheries Evaluation Biologist for the Spokane Tribe of Indians in eastern Washington. Welcome to the podcast, Travis.
Thanks for having me, Nick. I appreciate the opportunity, and I think you got a great forum going here for science communication.
Well, thank you. In between your semesters of school and in between your degrees, you worked for a variety of agencies in different states. What were some of the different jobs that you worked in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho?
So like I said, I was working these during my undergraduate education throughout that time period and then out. I started working for the U.S. Forest Service as a fisheries technician on small stream-dwelling salmonids. I spent a couple seasons on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest to kind of start out my if you want to call it, my fisheries career. And I really fell in love with it there. Working on West Slope cutthroat the first year, doing a lot of red surveys, a little bit of electrofishing, some native fish restoration. The next year, I was part of electrofishing crew, kind of tasked with evaluating all aspects of a timber sale, 150,000-acre project area, and got a lot of experience running those electrofishing crews and doing some native fish restoration work. After that, I took a position as a contract fisheries technician for the USGS, and I got a go out to eastern Montana and work on pallid sturgeon, federally endangered pallid sturgeon in the Yellowstone and Missouri rivers. It was really an eye-opening experience. We tracked them via use of radio telemetry, a lot of trammel nets, inserting radio tags, some early life history work with larval nets and young of the year. And that was really, really eye-opening moving from the salmonid world. After that, I came back to Western Montana, worked for the Madison River Foundation in cooperation with U.S. Forest Service, and I ran an electrofishing crew, doing a lot of electrofishing, and we also got to help on a lot of native fish restoration projects, those with the use of rotenone, and that's where I really, really fell in love with fisheries and where it kind of set me on my path today. After that, I took a stint in Yellowstone National Park. I worked for Hickey Brothers, that private company that's working on the removal of lake trout in Yellowstone Lake to the benefit of Yellowstone cutthroat. And after that, I went out back to eastern Montana, worked on pallid sturgeon for the state of Montana. I worked on the pallid sturgeon population estimate program. Again, those big river fishes, fish community structure in the Missouri River, trammel nets, trot lines, otter trawls, beam trawls, pike nets, so just a diversity of gears and, you know, just completely different from the trout world. And then finally after that, I went out to northern Idaho and worked on the Kootenai River white sturgeon. There's a federally endangered white sturgeon there for a couple seasons before I started my graduate work. And I actually worked with one of your previous guests, Andrew Ransom, here. We spent a season together up there. So that's kind of where I was before I started my graduate career.
Yeah, I'd imagine it was quite a change in your view of fisheries management, going from backpacker barge hawking those trout streams to working on the upper Missouri River for pallid sturgeon.
Yeah, and it was really good, because my real passions come in and at salmonids, but I gained just a tremendous amount of respect for those large river fishes. You know, we're running jet boats on those, and the same in the Kootenai. The Kootenai is a very large river, running big inboard jet boats on the Kootenai, and just, you know, we're pulling up in the white sturgeon. You know, they're upwards of 200 pounds, and those pallid sturgeons, I saw a female up to 66, one of those old adults. They're just amazing fish. And I mean, the whole fish community structure in the Missouri River, I mean, I know you've spent some time in the Mississippi, so you're well aware, but it's a really, really cool system. And like you say, completely different. And I implore any young fisheries professionals to really, really diversify your technician experience. It was one, just an amazing experience for me, but it was also really advantageous for my career.
You mentioned that you worked with Andrew Ransom, and in his episode 2 weeks ago, he mentioned that he thought that the field of fisheries was a great career field to really get out and explore the U.S., bounce around different parts of the country while you're earning that early career experience. And you've kind of done that a little bit with the upper Midwest, upper Great Plains area.
Yeah, I've been lucky to do that, and like Andrew has as well. I think it's, like you say, if there's some wanderlust and some young people that are interested in fisheries, it's a great way to do it.
You mentioned that you used quite a bit of different gear types there. Is there a certain type of fisheries gear that you haven't used yet that you're looking forward to trying out sometime in the future?
I guess what I haven't done a lot of actually is raft or drift boat electrofishing. I've done a lot via jet boat, and then also a very substantial amount with backpacks, as you hinted towards. I spent a lot of times in those small streams in my graduate work, but I haven't done a lot of the electrofishing out of a manual powered boat. That's what I look forward to doing more. And, you know, I enjoy rafts and drift boats. So that would probably be what I look forward to doing the most in the future.
Like you mentioned, you worked for different state, federal, or private agencies. What were some of the differences that you observed working for those three different entities or those three different types of employment opportunities?
That's a good question. And it really could, you know, have to do with what they're tasked with managing. So for the state, we're really tasked with managing the fish. And, you know, we're doing a lot more just actual fish work. When you think of fisheries, you know, we're sampling fish, where is the federal? Yes, we have sampling permits issued by the state, and of course we're sampling fish, but there's a much greater focus on habitat, because that's what they're more tasked with managing. They're land management agencies, and that's an important consideration when you're thinking about your career long term. I thoroughly enjoyed working for the federal government, for the Forest Service, and also as a contractor for the USGS. Personally, I do like that state aspect a little more, because, you know, they're the ones in control of those natural resources or the actual fish. And then finally, when it comes to private, I got to work cooperatively with the U.S. Forest Service when I worked for the Madison River Foundation. So that was an interesting scenario. But Hickey Brothers was also, you know, completely different, because they're just a contract fisheries company their sole goal in Yellowstone is to kill lake trout. And I haven't seen anyone as good as catching fish as when I worked for the Hickey Brothers, because they're commercial fishermen. They hail out of Wisconsin, and it was an interesting thing to see, because they were less concerned with, you know, the science, the biology behind it, and more concerned with their task, and that's to eliminate lake trout and absolutely as many as possible. And they're very effective at doing that.
And then what made you decide to head back to school and get your master's degree after working with all those different technician jobs?
So the plan all along for me, I knew since my freshman year of college, I was going to go to graduate school. That was the plan. And I worked every summer throughout my undergrad. And then I spent almost 3 years out before I started my graduate career, like you said, working different technician jobs. And I was really, for better or for worse, I was particular on position. I've hinted towards, I have a love of salmonids, and that's what I'm really passionate about. And I was just kind of waiting for the right project to come along, and I applied for a couple, and I got accepted to this project in South Dakota. working on brown trout ecology under Dr. Stephen Chips, who is an amazing advisor, and I can't say enough about him as a fishery scientist. So I was really just waiting for the right position, but I was also really enjoying my time as a technician. It's fun work, and I just had to go back, you know, and it was just kind of, that's how it ended up.
All right. And I Googled it earlier today, that the drive from Brookings to the Beaverhead River region, and it's about 14 hours. So that was pretty far drive. Are there as many wall drug signs heading east as there are heading west back home?
Yeah. There's a lot more heading east. I'll say that, I'm assuming you drove 90 there. They span pretty much South Dakota, whereas they taper out once you get into Wyoming on 90 there. So for better or for worse, there's a lot more going east.
Yeah, I'd imagine you got used to seeing them driving from Brookings to your study site in the Black Hills region.
Yeah, and that was also an issue with being so far with Brookings, South Dakota, where the university is located, as you're hinting towards, is all the way across the state where the Black Hills are on the western edge. So I spent some windshield time, but I also stayed out there all summer, my couple field seasons. So that made it a little better.
So your master's project looked at the effect of large-scale density reduction on brown trout growth in Spearfish Creek. I guess first, could you explain what a brown trout looks like to someone that has never seen or held one?
If viewers, or I guess listeners, haven't seen a trout before, I'm assuming most listeners generally know what trout morphology looks like. And brown trout follow that same general trend. They're a fusiform fish, and they follow that kind of counter shading. So darker on top, lighter on the bottom, kind of a green brown dorsal portion, changing more to a yellow orange on the belly of those fish. They got black and red spots, and like I say, they follow that general morphology of salmonids. They're gorgeous fish, and especially during the spawning season, like most salmonids. And I guess the one thing about brown trout that people don't realize, and I'm correcting people, is they're not native to the U.S. And they're native to Europe, Northern Africa, and Western Asia. And they're one of the most widely distributed fish species on the planet. And they provide these important angling opportunities basically across their entirety of their range. So they're important sport fish wherever they're found.
They get to a fairly good size for a trout, don't they?
Yeah, brown trout can live close to 20 years. And I mean, they can grow above, most stream dwelling trout are not, but they can be beyond 20 pounds. Yeah. The Montana state record is 29 pounds. I guess that's just, if you give a regional kind of, it's kind of hard to think of world records, but in Montana, it's 29 pounds.
So then your project was looking at large scale density reduction. What is density dependent growth, and why are you trying to reduce it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So most of you have probably heard the term stunting. And basically all that is an overabundance of a fish species that's competing for a limited resource, a finite resource. And their growth is being negatively affected due to that competition. And that's basically what density dependent growth is, this high abundance of fish competing for a finite resource that's negatively affecting their growth. And that's basically what's going on within Spearfish Creek. And my research was tasked with density reduction as a management technique in order to reduce that intraspecific competition and hopefully improve growth rates within Spearfish Creek.
I always explain to people that your pond or your lake or your river, whatever you're trying to manage, is like a box, and you can fit so many fish in that box. And depending on their size, you can fit more or less smaller ones in there. So if you want more fish, some of those larger fish have to kind of shrink down, and so you can fit more small fish in.
That's a great analogy. I'm going to steal that. Yeah.
As you mentioned, the brown trout aren't native to the United States. Are the brown trout in this region out competing any native trout?
So that's also a good question. So actually the Black Hills are sort of an island out there on the prairie, and there is actually no native salmonids to the Black Hills. They are cold water fisheries, but there was only native catascomids and cyprinids prior to Western settlement. So brown trout and were first introduced to the Black Hills in 1890, and also brook trout and rainbow trout and cutthroat trout were also introduced in those late 1800s. So there were actually no native salmonids. And in Spearfish Creek, they've, in the reaches I work, they've actually completely taken over the fish community structure. Where there is native fishes in the lower reaches of Spearfish Creek, I sampled over 28,000 fish, and 98% of them were brown trout, and the remaining 2%-ish were rainbow trout with like one brook trout and a handful of cutthroat trout. Yes, they've basically outcompeted everything from Spearfish Creek, which is kind of sad from a native fish perspective, but it also provides recreational fisheries, some pretty important recreational fisheries. So take it or leave it, that's kind of where we're at right now.
Then what did your project figure out on the large-scale density reduction part of it?
Yeah, so I'll kind of preface it with at least some numbers behind that. So we talked about density-dependent growth. So Spearfish Creek, we saw brown trout biomass is about 3 times greater in Spearfish Creek than Rapid Creek. And that's a comparable Black Hill stream and also similar to other Black Hill streams that hold brown trout. And then those fish were about 30 to 40% smaller in Spearfish Creek, we're seeing adult fish. So that's what we're talking about, that density dependence, that growth. So like we stated before, I'm looking to use localized density reductions as a technique to fight this high abundance, slow growth. A big question I get asked a lot on that idea isn't angler harvest the intuitive solution to combating density dependent growth? And due to social stigmas associated with harvesting wild trout, and then just current harvest levels, it's highly unlikely that increasing bag limits would increase harvest to the levels we would need. The social stigma in angling culture for catch and release is highly ingrained. It's similar to musky fishermen in the Midwest, which many of you are probably familiar with, or maybe tournament bass fishermen. So that's kind of why we didn't go that way. And I looked at 2 major problems in my project. First, the actual growth differences of these density reductions from natural density sites, and then also movement, because movement was going to be important. If fish are just moving in mass from these high density natural areas to these newfound low density areas, that was going to basically mitigate all of our reduction efforts. So those were the 2 things I looked at. And we sampled 14 sites. I had 14 quarter mile sites. 50% of those sites served as our removal sites. And what we did in 2016 was remove 50% of the brown trout density in those 7 sites. The remaining 7, we sampled via backpack electrofishing. I deployed pit tags as a means of tracking growth with that first objective I talked about, and also as a low resolution technique for looking at movement. We also sacrificed fish in each section for otolith analysis. A lot of your prior guests have talked about otolith, yes, inner ear bones of fish, and I section those, or bed them in epoxy, section those, and look at them under a microscope in order to age fish. And I use that to build age length keys and apply these keys to the remaining fish in order to get ages for the remaining fish captured. I did this as a way to look at age specific differences in growth. 2017, we returned to the creek. We're sampling it again, 3-pass electrofishing depletion. We're scanning all those fish for those pit tags, those passive integrated transponders. And I guess I should probably explain those. They're basically what your veterinarian, or they are what your veterinarian would put in your cat or your dog. They're an individual ID marker, and basically allows us to track fish growth between our year period. In between the 2016 and 17 sampling season, I also deployed radio tags over the entirety of the year, again looking at that movement problem, like we said before. And what we saw was, first off, we were concerned with abundance. And what we saw was, in our removal sites, We saw a 20% reduction on average in brown trout abundance from 2016 to 2017. Our control sites, we saw an on average increase of about 4%. So we were able to successfully reduce that intraspecific competition or the abundance of those fish over the entirety of that study period. So that bodes well moving forward and being able to use this technique to improve growth. When we looked at our growth rates, we saw a significant increase for age 3 and 4-year-old brown trout for length. We saw an on-average increase for those older cohorts, 5 and 6-year-old fish. However, we were not able to statistically detect that increase. And again, that's most likely due to small sample sizes for those older fish, and then also just the asymptotic nature of fish growth. Yes, fish have indeterminate growth. However, growth within Spearfish Creek is slowing right around age 4, and it's asymptoting up there. I fitted a bunch of von Berlanti growth functions, and that's basically what we're seeing at Spearfish Creek. So we were able to improve this growth in length and weight for 3-4-year-old fish, and then on average increases for 5 and 6-year-old fish. However, we did not detect those same differences for age 1 and age 2-year-old fish. And the big question is why are we seeing these age-specific differences in growth? And I really got at that with the brown trout's bioenergetics model. And what we used that for is to estimate first the annual consumption for each cohort of brown trout, and then also their I guess that'd be their annual energy budget. So what are the calories that fish needs to sustain its current body mass? I also estimated consumption of each cohort of fish based on their observed growth rates, and then also broke that consumption up by prey type, both aquatically derived and terrestrially derived prey. And what we saw for age 1 and age 2-year-old fish, they're greatly exceeding their annual energy budget for aquatically derived prey sources alone. So they're able to maintain their current body mass and put a ton of energy towards growth just feeding on aquatic invertebrates. However, those 3 through 6-year-old aged fish are either insufficient in meeting their annual energy demands or just barely meeting those annual energy demands feeding on aquatically derived prey sources as a whole. And what those older cohorts are having to do in order to first gain their larger body sizes and put energy towards growth is rely heavily on terrestrial-derived prey sources. And this was really interesting as us being able to identify the mechanism as to why first these older cohorts are more susceptible to this density-dependent growth, and then also why they're gaining more benefit from these large-scale density reductions. And then I guess finally, we looked at movement. Movement within Spearfish Creek, they generally showed small movements, small net movements, and small home ranges. And we didn't see a lot of fish moving away from their home pool, their home boulder, their home bend, wherever that may be. And we did not detect any evidence of increased or decreased movements or home ranges in response to these large-scale density reductions. So again, this is boding well for our ability to keep these reduced intraspecific competitions and hopefully continue to improve growth beyond our study period of 1 year. So those were our general findings, and that was kind of a long-winded response, but I hope you guys got the gist of what I did there.
So then is Spearfish Creek or the other creeks in the Black Hills region, are they stocked or are they self-sustaining populations?
Spearfish Creek is wild is managed as a wild trout fishery. There's no stocking going on. Generally, that's what the Black Hills is managed as. There's a little bit of stocking going on, and they're stocking in reservoirs and impoundments pretty consistently. But generally, all the flowing waters in the Black Hills are managed as wild trout fisheries, and Spearfish Creek is exclusively managed as a wild trout fishery. So these are all wild, self-sustaining fish, and that's a really, really cool caveat to that.
How does the information that you found in your thesis help the biologist in the Black Hills region and other brown trout fisheries manage their populations?
Well, I think it can be used for many stream-dwelling trout, but in particular the Black Hills. First, it informs anglers of just a lot of characteristics of, or not anglers, managers of a lot of characteristics of Spearfish Creek. Like I said, I did a lot of different things to characterize the brown trout fishery in Spearfish Creek. But my actual research, I think, can be used as if managers want to use large-scale density reductions as a management technique. First and foremost, we saw that it can be used to improve growth. But I think the interesting caveat is what needs to be taken into consideration by managers that are considering using this technique is what are our limiting factors? And are those limiting factors going to be the same for all cohorts? We saw some definite age-specific differences in the limiting factors on growth. And that was really important for our ability to improve growth for those different cohorts. So I think that would be the main gist of what managers or researchers will take from my thesis.
Well, Travis, thank you for talking about your thesis. Have you already defended it?
Yep. Yeah, I defended in August or so, and I've had it all accepted by the graduate school, and I'm looking to publish a little bit of work off of that, and we're working on some side projects right now just before I start my job here in the new job in January. So that's basically where I'm at right now.
And so your new job is with the Spokane Tribe of Indians in Eastern Washington. What will you be doing there for them?
So I'm going to be one of the fisheries biologists, one on the Lake Roosevelt Fisheries Evaluation Program. And the main mission behind that is to restore, conserve, and protect the robust fishery in Lake Roosevelt. And generally, I'm going to be working with rainbow trout, kokanee, introduced smallmouth bass, and walleye. And they have some pike problems there that they're dealing with for non-native and invasive pike. But generally, that's I'm going to be working on that fishery, and I'm just excited to tackle a new set of problems. You know, it'll be exciting to work for a new agency in a new area.
All right. Well, that's the tough part of the interview. And so now, as you know, we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
My favorite fish is the Yellowstone cutthroat trout. It holds a special place, both angling and being able to work professionally to conserve Yellowstone cutthroat trout. And it's one of the two native cutthroats to Montana, and it's just it's kind of got that two-headed approach, I guess, for me. It's a special fish, and they're gorgeous. I think everyone should check them out.
And then what is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
My favorite memory, I guess, would probably have to be I was working for the U.S. Forest Service, and I got the opportunity to help on a native fish restoration project in Yellowstone National Park, Grayling Creek in particular. It was a rote gnome project. There was a barrier put on the permanent barrier built into the stream. And we were part of the initial crew to remove all non-natives from that fishery. I believe it was in 2014. But anyway, we were in the backcountry using rote gnome to remove all the non-natives from this fish. Way in the backcountry, the helicopter gear in. We actually had camp chefs. I've never had that. It was wild. But it was just hard work, and they were trying to, you know, keep the crew happy. Long days. You know, and then this is backcountry, you know, pepper spray with bears, messing around in camp and no trail stuff. It was just a really, really special experience. And it's kind of formed how or what I'd like to work on in the future.
That leads us into our next question with what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
And like I say, that was formative. It's kind of just accumulation of all things. At least at this point in my career, my dream job would probably be working for a state agency and working to conserve native salmonids. I'd love to do some, again, native fish restoration projects, most likely in the Montana, Idaho, Wyoming area. That's I really like that those northern Rockies, and they're just, to me, they're just special.
All right. And then if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I'm generally following a common theme here, but it would be a large tributary of maybe the Yellowstone, Madison, Gallatin, Henry's Fork, but a native fish restoration project in one of those. I've got to work as, you know, a part of one of those. I'd love to lead one of those projects someday, and that's kind of a goal of mine to you know, restore a large tributary to be a source for native salmonids. in one of those iconic trout streams of the West. I think that'd be very, you know, pretty cool and a goal to work towards someday.
And if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think mine would have to be support wild fish. I'm assuming everyone listening here is either one, their occupation is fisheries, or they're also fisheries or habitat are a very important part of their life. They're passionate about it. They're interested about it. And I think we kind of owe it to those resources to be advocates for those fish and places. Join your local TU club, join the Native Fish Society, whatever that may be. Help with river cleanup. Just being an advocate for those fish and places is a powerful thing. The social value, if we can place a social value on these places and fishes, it can be contagious. And I think that would just, in short, support wild fish. I think that's kind of, it should be our responsibility. If we don't do it as a community of passionate individuals, I don't think anybody will.
Well, Travis, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about the work you did in the Black Hills region, and best of luck to you moving forward with your job in Eastern Washington.
I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks, Nick, for all you do for this podcast. I think it's a great forum, like I said earlier.
Thank you. If people want to find out more information or to get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, right now I'm right between professional emails, so probably the best way would be rehm.travis@gmail. I'd be happy to take it on that personal email. Like I said, I'm flipping over right now. I still have graduate emails and I'm yet to get that my new email. So send emails there. I'd be happy to talk about anything.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at @FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Listen in next week when I talk to Katie O'Reilly about FishMiss and how that all got started. You can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 17th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, support wild fish.